We chose as the theme to our exhibition, and when I say we did, there are actually four curators who worked on this show, and we had lots of discussions about the exhibition all together. And that included Kelly Gordon, who was my co-curator on this first part of the exhibition, which is called Dreams, under this umbrella heading of the cinema effect. And then Kristen Heilman and Ann Elgood, other curators on staff, took over for the second half of the exhibition, which will open in June, as Ryan mentioned. And that takes a look at a more realistic side of things. But in both cases, I think one draws the conclusion that you can't always know what you're looking at. The first half really takes a look at the way that we enter a kind of dream space in cinema, and the way that a lot of artists have used the moving image to explore that concept, this kind of cinematic idea of shifting from reality into a dream world, and then maybe some questioning about whether we ever move back out of that dream world nowadays, or whether those two things have become blurred for us. And the second half will take a look at more a kind of documentary side, a more realistic view of things. And yet, in that exhibition, I think you will also find that Kristen and Ann have done, I think you'll also find a confusion between reality and illusion. So thus the theme of the two different shows. So it's rather experimental in the sense that we, because film and video take time to watch, we actually are taking time to present them. And so for the next 7-8 months, there's going to be film and video presented as the exhibitions here at the Hirshhorn, along with, of course, our black box space, which has Ravane Neuenschwander in it right now, a fantastic Brazilian artist whose work is really incredible and has received quite a bit of attention. Then the film program that we also do. We have actually a really great film program coming up this summer, which I probably shouldn't even mention yet, but I want to anyway because it just fits the theme so well. And that is, it's a bit of a tribute to Ray Harryhausen, which most people probably don't know. Art world people don't know Ray Harryhausen, but I know who Ray Harryhausen is because he was my favorite when I was a kid growing up. He learned from the great Willis O'Brien, who did King Kong, which links itself to this exhibition, actually, if you've been through it upstairs, how to do stop motion techniques, and then all those great films from the 50s and 60s, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, 20 Million Miles to Earth, were done by Ray Harryhausen, who has now colorized his black and white films, and we'll be presenting those in our summer camp film series. So there's a lot of film coming up at the museum, and I hope you'll come and see it all. Today, I want to give you some idea of some of the concepts that came up in my mind, at least, about the cinema effect in thinking about this. And I want to give you sort of this notion. I want to put forward this notion today that I feel when I say the cinema effect, naturally it refers to the cinema, but in fact, I only call it the cinema because I think the cinema, the movies, were the ultimate form of expression of this desire to confuse illusion and reality, which has been going on since the beginning of mankind. And the cinema was simply the ultimate form of it, the best form of it, the most effective form of it. And what I want to show today is I want to go back and I want to actually explore some of the areas that existed before the cinema, and then also what happened to the cinema in terms of kind of coming out of what it used to be as the great films of the 20th century in the movie palaces, and what it's become now, because it's something different now. There's no longer one cinema. There's a thousand different kinds of cinema now. There's cinema that, you know, you can slip into your pocket with your iPod and carry around with you, much like the 19th century when it was first born. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And we're going to start, actually, with a filmmaker who is very important to me and to my thinking on the show as well as to the other curators, and that is Jean-Luc Godard. And by the way, I don't believe Ryan mentioned, but in May, the Silver Theater AFI is going to be presenting in conjunction with this exhibition a survey of Jean-Luc Godard's work, including Alphaville, which is one of the films that has been on my mind for some reason. Some strange reason ever since we started talking about this. And so I'd like to sort of plunge into Godard and have Godard be the launching point for this exhibition. In 1965, Jean-Luc Godard made this film called Alphaville, and it starred Eddie Constantine as this film noir detective named Lemmy Caution, who had actually appeared in some books. He was not made up just by Godard. And it also starred Anna Karenina as Natasha von Braun, who was this wonderful, beautiful woman who was the daughter of Professor von Braun, who had invented this evil machine that had taken over Alphaville called the Alpha 60 computer. Now remember, this is 1965, but Alphaville had fallen under the spell of the Alpha 60 computer. It was a computer that had taken away all sentimental words out of the dictionary. Words like love were gone out of the dictionary, and was in control of Alphaville. So from the outer lands, Lemmy Caution, our detective hero, is brought into Alphaville to save Alphaville. So he comes into Alphaville in his Ford Galaxy, and he manages to destroy the Alpha 60 computer. And so it ends on a happy note, as it were, with him falling in love with Natasha. Natasha not knowing how to say, I love you, but finally managing to say it in almost a kind of computer way, I love you, at the end of the film. Now, my feeling is that Godard already knew back in 1965, it was very prescient about what was happening with the world and what was going to happen with the world, just like Andy Warhol seemed to predict much of what's going on today. And it's my idea that it wasn't Lemmy Caution who won ultimately, it was the Alpha 60 computer that actually won and took over Alphaville after Lemmy had left. And in fact, has taken over our cities nowadays, that we all live in a place called Alphaville now. There's a book by, really quite a brilliant book by Chris Dark called Alphaville. And I'll just show you that here's an image that doesn't come from the film Alphaville. It actually comes from a little gated community on the outskirts of Sao Paulo that was named Alphaville and after the film. And so we have this moment where something out of a movie actually begins to exist in reality. And it was a gated community that had security cameras around and that watched everybody all the time. And it was actually appeared in a Brazilian soap opera in which it would get mentioned on the soap opera a lot. So there was this strange back and forthness between illusion and reality, between fiction and nonfiction. And Chris Dark, in his book, actually calls it the Alphaville effect. Now, here's another image of it, the gated community of Alphaville outside of Sao Paulo. Now, Godard, I think, was already aware of the fact that Alphaville was real, because he chose to actually shoot Alphaville, the film, in Paris of 1965, when the film's when he made the film. Theoretically, it takes place in the future, but there is absolutely nothing in the film in terms of special effects besides a little bit of negative film footage or some brightly lit scenes and some shadowy things that someone like Jean Cocteau would have done 20 years before. There's no special effects in the film. It's all filmed in the newer parts of Paris. It's filmed in 1965 Paris. So Paris of 1965 actually stands in for Alphaville of the future. In fact, ultimately, Godard had actually said that he wasn't telling the story about the future. He said, I'm telling the story of a man from 20 years ago, Lemmy Caution, who discovers the world today and can't believe it. It's not about the future. It's about Lemmy being hurled from the past, from the days of film noir, from the great cinema of the 20s, 30s, 40s, the great movie palaces, out of that and into the present at the time, which is Alphaville, which is Paris of 1965. And you find little hints back to the golden era of the cinema in the work. Little suggestions about Lumiere, light, is all over this film. And of course, it's about the Lumiere brothers themselves, who in a wonderful way share that name of the light of cinema with their own names, which is Lumiere. And they were the ones that really invented the cinema in 1895. There are homages to German expressionism. There are people which, you know, you turn and say, Monsieur Nosferatu in it, and there's all kinds of homages to German expressionism and to the actual film apparatus with pulsating lights throughout the film. So it's the use of Paris as Alphaville to suggest that the Paris once known by Godard, a sort of lovely city, is now being dehumanized by new technologies, by the computer, but it's also a place that's far removed from the classic cinema, and that he's suggesting that you can use the vocabulary of classic cinema, but now it's being used at a distance. It's being used in a way that is very self-referential. Now, basically, Godard tells us two things in Alphaville: that the classic cinema is dead, but also that a new kind of cinematic world has begun to take shape. And, you know, it's a kind of expanded cinema, a cinema that refers back to its own history. And it basically is a moving image society in which film has spilled out of the great movie palace cathedrals of the 1930s and 40s and has spread into the city itself, into the way we live and is influencing the way we think nowadays. Alphaville is no longer merely a place in a Godard film. It's not even a Sao Paulo community named after that film. It is Paris, it's New York, it's Tokyo, it's Berlin, it's Los Angeles, it's Shanghai, and it's the places where technology has really splintered conventional film practice into thousands of new kinds of cinema. In Alphaville, cinemas confused with DVD technology, with LEDs on the sides of buildings, with powerful projection that is shot now on buildings and makes them almost liquid and disappear. It's confused with the computer screen that I'm staring at right here, with iPods in which you can download films or television shows onto them. Reality television shows are not reality at all, but take the tropes, the vocabulary of dramatic television shows, which hark back to the cinema itself. And the conventional frame of cinema, which was more like a painting, has broken apart into hundreds of windows back into one another, each one providing countless entries into other places and other worlds, all layered on top of one another. We now, as I mentioned, you know, can carry cinema around in our pockets, and also we all can make movies nowadays. It's easy to make a film now with the technology, so you can all be directors. There's a little guy up in the exhibition who's hanging on the wall at one point, if you've seen the show, by Tony Ousler, one of the artists in the exhibition, and he's giving directions, and Tony likes to think of him as the director, and he's directing you in the audience. And so we're all directors now, just like that piece in the exhibition. So Godard had predicted that life would indeed be shaped by computers. And really, nowadays, where you used to have to enter a movie theater to experience the cinematic, you have no need of entering a movie theater now to experience cinema. Life itself is basically just like a movie. So the question becomes for me is sort of, where did this start? I mean, did this just come out of cinema, or does it hark back to something that existed even before cinema, to desires that mankind has had right from the start? And, you know, I would like to propose that it's not just the cinema that this comes out of, but it actually predates the cinema, and the cinema is only the greatest manifestation of it. The desire for illusion certainly goes all the way back in history. The great film historian Jean-Louis Baudry has actually suggested that in order to understand the cinema, that one, quote, constantly has to return to the scene of the cave, to Lascaux, to Altamira, and I think that's true. And I think that's where the first filmmakers, in a sense, actually developed. They learned to create these simulations of the real that I'm sure, in the flickering firelight, could at times seem to move and to come to life. They were really the world's first movie theaters. And I can imagine hiking through the kind of dark labyrinths that culminated in this chamber at the end of the labyrinth, this sort of underground space, much like a movie theater. And in fact, those underground chambers where this began certainly then transformed later into things like the camera obscura, which was a dark black box kind of space in which the light from the outside would come through that aperture, that hole in the cave, that opening to the cave, and an image would then be placed inside the black box, which was essentially the invention of photography. And also these caves in Lascaux, where the animals were painted on the wall and the firelight was making them come to life, were both a representation of something that wasn't there, an illusion. And they were also the projection themselves with the firelight, which was exactly like the world's first movies, the Lumiere Brothers cinematograph, which both recorded on film movies and also played them back. It was a projector as well. It was a camera and projector. And so, we haven't gone very far. It's very much still like the cave in a funny sort of way. Here's a couple of images. I couldn't help but put these in. This is some image I found of Plato's cave and the idea that people were actually fooled when Plato talks about the cave, this idea that they were prisoners of illusions inside this cave and preferred the illusionary existence over the reality that was outside the cave. And then an image by Mike Kelly, a great West Coast artist, and called Plato's Cave, Rothko's Chapel, and Lincoln's Profile, all coming together in this underground chamber. I'm going to throw in, once in a while, an image from the show, because in the thinking about it, these were some of the reasons for picking some of the works that were in the show. And the idea of beginning the exhibition with this work by Douglas Gordon called Off Screen was certainly purposeful. It was the idea that you would have to pass into the world of cinema, that you would open the red curtain that usually is the curtain on our cinema screens, but that you would have to physically go to that other side of the screen where the cinema exists. And you would now be part of the world of cinema and not just part of the world of reality, thereby confusing the two things. Your shadow then is cast upon the red curtain. You become the movie that plays on the screen. We are all living in the world of cinema now. We are all in the movies, not just going to the movies. And I couldn't help but show that even the movies themselves seem to think about this, that a lot of the title sequences to movies often take place against a curtain which is not the real curtain at all, but takes the place of the real curtain in the movie theater. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, a curtain. The Robe is placed against the curtain, and The Robe was actually the first CinemaScope film. And I couldn't find a good image, but another example is David Lynch's Blue Velvet, which again, the credit sequence is against a blue velvet curtain in that case. And if caves were the first place where cinema actually existed, I think they find their next sort of manifestation in gardens. These are the gardens of Alhambra, but we could use almost any early gardens as examples. These were places that were meant to basically transport you some other place. In the case of Alhambra, it transports you to paradise, to a garden of Allah. And the kinds of plantings that were used with their odors and their colors were meant to actually take you to a kind of paradise. So you were transported from the real world, from a kind of dry, dusty existence outside, to where water was extremely important, to paradise on the inside. The garden visitor, you, the person who actually goes to a garden, was discussed by the great historian and garden historian Raymond Williams, who described the visitor to the garden as a self-conscious observer, the man who is not only looking at land, but who is conscious that he is doing so. So now we get into that place where you know you're experiencing an illusion, you suspend your disbelief, enough that you can enter it, but you also sort of know that it really is an illusion. So the onlooker is willing to be transported to an elsewhere, to some other place, and uses his imagination in part to actually get there. The 18th century English parks had their origins in hunting woodlands, and they date back probably all the way to the 10th century. But they were also fostered by painting. They took their shape out of many of the painters of the 16th and 17th century, particularly the works of Solomon van Ruysdael, Claude Lorrain, and Nicolas Poussin, who were very popular on the grand tours to Italy at the time, and also helped shape garden design in England. In a way, you know, it seems like, well, the garden is so different from the cinema, but yet both of them were really forged out of real scientific inquiry, as well as a kind of desire to improve upon nature. And this is certainly something that crops up in the movies all the time, is this desire to create the picturesque in the movies, just as it was created in the gardens in England, in a film like The Wizard of Oz, which actually takes place almost entirely outside, but is filmed entirely inside. Or say Stanley Kubrick's interest in recreating the 17th century landscape painting in a film like Barry Lyndon that we have an example of here. It was to exaggerate the actual landscape into something picturesque in order to enhance the viewer's sense of being transported to some other place and some other time. And of course, this carries on to the video games of the 1990s, like the Myst series that was introduced in 1993. This idea of the concept of the garden being a kind of transportation device that could take you elsewhere. Amphitheaters actually have often been part of garden settings, and the garden has often been confused with a kind of stage set. And you know, it was a place where follies and where false ruins could actually make you feel that you were transported to another era, a kind of magical time, and that you could actually participate in some kind of allegorical fantasies. Here's an image of the pleasure gardens at Vauxhall in London. And you can see these pavilions and these rotundas that were put into place in which actual theatrical performances would take place. Dan Graham, the wonderful contemporary artist, has done a lot of thinking about the garden, cinema, and the theater. And I'd like to read you a short quote by him, which I think brings it all together. He said, "By the period of the Italian Baroque, garden design and theater design were so closely connected that they directly influenced each other. The Baroque garden, treated metaphorically as a vast natural theater, usually contained one or more areas for theater performances. The theater's architectural boundaries were defined by boxed hedges, grass, stone, statuary, and seating areas." And Graham goes on to note that there was a kind of blurring of the theater space and the garden. Productions sometimes used the garden's pathways or vistas and spilled over from the amphitheaters into the garden themselves. So the great 18th century English gardens such as Stowe or Rousham or Studley Royal Water Garden or Starhead, with their sort of arches and their pavilions and their follies and their fake temples, still to this day, if you wander through them, especially if it's kind of hazy or foggy or it's in the twilight, tend to plunge us back to classical antiquity or to other times where we become sort of characters in some kind of mythical drama. And in another sense, it also compresses time to where distant times come right up into the present and the two things are brought together, much as they can be in the cinema. This is an image of something called a switchback. It's an early form of the roller coaster, and this was called Niagara Falls in the Ruggieri Gardens in Paris in the early 19th century. And so what we see here is the beginnings, the transformation from the sort of English gardens of the 18th century into the 19th century, and really at places, even at Vauxhall, and places like the Jardin de Tivoli in Paris and the Prater in Vienna, we begin to get the beginnings of the amusement park. The ride actually begins to develop. And here we have an early example of this kind of roller coaster ride. I thought I had one more slide there, but I don't. I mean, ultimately, this led to the birth of the amusement park, which took its probably primary representation, its most interesting form, in the beginning of the 20th century, in 1906 to be exact, with the opening of Luna Park on Coney Island in New York City. And Dan Graham, Dan, by the way, I just want to throw out, has written a lot about gardens, and we have commissioned a pavilion by Dan Graham. If you know his work, he's actually a sculptor who uses glass to create pavilions in garden settings. And in April, we'll be installing a piece by Dan out in our own garden here at the Hirshhorn. But he suggested, quite rightly, I think, that electric lighting was responsible for the birth of film and the amusement park, which are born almost exactly at the same time. And also, around 1900, Freud's theory of the unconscious, the cinema, and Coney Island all appear almost exactly at this same time. Rem Koolhaas, the great architect, actually has said that Coney Island was probably an unconscious dreamscape for the conscious, rational world of New York City. When the visitor entered Luna Park, and which opened in 1906, it was through a small rocket ship that was planted a little ways into the facility, which certainly echoed the work of Georges Méliès, who was one of the pioneers of the fictional film. The idea that films could tell a story, a narrative, that you could disappear into this other world, a world of science fiction, a world of fantasy, and he, of course, was a magician himself. And this is an image from Trip to the Moon by Georges Méliès from 1902, which predates the 1906 opening of Luna Park, which had a ride called A Trip to the Moon. However, there was, by the same people who actually invented Luna Park, who created Luna Park, someone named Frederick Thompson and Elmer Dundee, they had actually beaten Méliès to A Trip to the Moon with a cyclorama type of ride that was presented in the Buffalo World's Fair in 1901. That was also called A Trip to the Moon. And here you see this image that was photographed from the cyclorama from the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo in 1901, thereby beating Méliès out to the punch, actually. So again, this confusion of what was cinematic and what was actually a theme park, both happening almost at the same time. That's a little photograph I found, which I love. This is as you were walking through the Trip to the Moon ride in Buffalo in 1901, and these little men came out, these little creatures from the moon, and would do little somersaults and things like that in front of you. And then at the end of the ride, you were actually handed a piece of green cheese, because as we all know, the moon was made out of cheese. Luna Park was probably the most effective, as our many all amusement parks and carnivals, at night when all the lights came on. And we have to, Dietrich Neumann is going to be here, as Ryan said, to really talk about this whole phenomenon of the lighted building, of the buildings that take on a different kind of manifestation, that the solidness of the building disappears in the light of night. But all the World's Fairs of 1899, of 1900, and 1901, back in 1893 in Chicago, all made use of these complex and very powerful forms of lighting that took place, and this idea that buildings could become a kind of liquid, non-solid sort of state. The actual city outside of the World's Fair, or outside of Luna Park, outside of the amusement park, would disappear from all the lights that were hitting you within the park itself. So again, this experience of the disappearance of reality as you enter this other world, this fantasy world. And I have some questions quotes here about Luna Park when it first opened in 1906. They're all wonderful. I'm just going to read you a partial quote from one of them, but this is by Maxim Gorky, who traveled to New York and witnessed the opening of Luna Park, and he says, "With the advent of night, a fantastic city, all of fire, suddenly rises from the ocean into the sky. Thousands of ruddy sparks glimmer in the darkness, limning in fine, sensitive outline on the black background of the sky." And he concludes the quote by saying, "Fabulous beyond conceiving, ineffably beautiful is this fiery scintillation." So this was kind of a big deal. It was something very new. So darkness allowed the dream, in a sense, to be fully realized. And the surrounding world no longer existed. It disappeared. And the visitor would then, just like when they went to the movies, these early movies that were coming out at this time, like the Méliès films, would have to, as Coleridge described, would have to have the willing suspension of disbelief in order to believe what they were about to see. And that's where you get into this situation where you're willingly suspending your disbelief, although you kind of know it's a dream that you're in. It's very much like a dream that way. And you kind of know you're dreaming, but you sort of don't know you're dreaming too. And then you think, well, maybe I'm just dreaming. And then you think, oh no, I'm not really dreaming. But then as it turns out, you really are dreaming. So you could take these impossible voyages into other worlds, trips to other places, and in many cases, there would be a kind of mascot in these amusement parks. And in one of the first ones, you had a mascot in Klampenborg, Denmark, which is one of the first actual amusement parks, and is still in existence, I believe. The mascot was actually Piero Lunaire. So he was being, you know, made crazy by the moon and by the moonlight. And so he's the mascot still, I believe, at Klampenborg in Denmark. I wanted to throw this piece in by Gary Hill because it's a work called Suspension of Disbelief for Marine from 1991 by Gary, and it's a work in the exhibition. And it's a very interesting work because I think it brings a digital technology, video technology, and cinema technology in the sense of the flickering of the piece. If you've seen it upstairs, it flickers very quickly, flickering like the cinema. And also it's like a piece of film almost strung across the gallery setting. To just tell you, I'm not talking much about the actual pieces today, but the ideas behind the whole show, but just to tell you that in this piece, he had a girlfriend named Maureen at the time, and they were on opposite coasts, and he filmed them separately and then brought their bodies together in this particular piece. And in order to believe that you were together, you had to suspend your disbelief. Just to mention that right next to Luna Park was another park that was built called Dreamland. And again, this idea that you were entering some other kind of place, the world of dreams. Now, in the 1920s, developed another kind of way into the dream, and that was the ghost train or dark ride. They became popular in the 1920s, and there was this invention, particularly by a company called the Pretzel Amusement Ride Company, in which they started to use cars that were on tracks that would lead you through either tunnels of love, wonderful places, or places that would send you to hell, to these Dante's Infernos, to places that were ghost train rides. And it would be a small car running on this track. And you can get the idea of some of these places, you know, with the titles of the rides themselves. Things called The Caveman, Haunted House, Lost Mine, Bucket of Blood, The Devil's Inn, Orient Express, Mad Giant, Laugh in the Dark, Pirate's Cave, Paris After Dark, Arabian Nights, Tunnel of Love, Spookorama, and Dante's Inferno, just to name a few of the rides that developed in the 1920s and 1930s. I show you some images here, one of a car from a ride of the 1920s. Tony Ousler's work, which I mentioned already, which gives you the feeling of being on a dark ride, was one reason for including it in the exhibition. The eye, this kind of voyeuristic medium. Tony, by the way, likes to think of the little man on the right, played by David Bowie, by the way, that he is the director who's directing you, whereas on the left, the eyeball is actually the camera. And then up in the exhibition, you'll find the actress laying on the floor in one part of the exhibition, going through a whole series of emotions, in a sense being directed by the director. On the right-hand side, you see a couple images from Darren Ahman's Geisterbahn, or Ghost Train, which he filmed on, from the front of a car on a ghost train ride that still exists in Vienna, and then added this soundtrack to it. What I wanted to happen was in the exhibition that you would be pulled further along as you went through the show. Earlier in the show, there's a train with a piece by Stan Douglas, which is called Overture, in which the concepts that Proust sort of tossed around at the beginning of Remembrance of Things Past about being half asleep and half awake are read over the top of this train moving through these dark tunnels. A little further on in the show, you then get Geisterbahn, which sucks you in deeper into the maybe the part of sleep that's the most horrific, into your nightmares, a little later in the exhibition. And actually, I'm sure that the concept of the dark ride, you know, gets some of its energy out of things that came before as well, such as the magic lantern shows of the 18th and 19th century. You see a couple images from them here. And these were phantasmagorias that could actually be traced all the way back to probably 1645 and the work of Athanasius Kircher, who actually invented these kind of dark chambers where mirrors could bring light in on the inside and then create these phantasmagorias. But with these rides, just like with these dark chambers, just like with movies, you were in a fixed place, and the movie itself had to move you through. The phantasmagoria had to take you through. Whereas with the dark ride, you were actually moving through physically, and you were trapped. You might even physically be roped in to these cars that would take you through the dark ride, where you didn't know what was going to happen from one minute to the next. Now, we wanted to give you a little bit of that feeling in the exhibition, which is why the exhibition seems a bit maze-like. That's on purpose. It's not just to get a series of dark rooms. It was actually to have you wander through some dark areas and not actually know what was going to happen the next with the next corner that you turn. And so it's meant to be a little bit like a dark ride, or a little bit like a labyrinth, which in another way is a precursor to a dark ride. Labyrinths were places where you would get lost and where sometimes a monster was hiding somewhere around the corner. Again, all these things sort of come together in this sort of cinematic form in terms of the dark ride, the amusement park, and cinema itself. In a book by a social historian named Norman Klein called, the title's great, called The Vatican to Vegas, A History of Special Effects, he says, the spectator is often sent into a fictional space where the exit is hidden. Another thing we wanted to do in the exhibition itself was not to let you have a way out of the show. Of course, you can push one of the exit doors open somewhere to get out, but like a dark ride where you can't get out of it once you've started it, and like a dream, you can't get out of it once you start it, we wanted to give you that feeling that you just had to keep turning corners and moving through the exhibition and what was going to happen next. And in fact, I don't know if you've noticed about the show, but you're basically, it's a night of sleep in some ways, which is kind of our personal structure, where you go through the curtain to enter the arena of sleep. You see Andy Warhol's piece, Sleep, from 1963, is one of his earliest films, this long 5.5 hour film. I'm sorry, we only put a 100-minute excerpt in the exhibition. However, we will be screening, as Ryan mentioned, the entire 5.5 hours on a Sunday if you'd like to come and see all that. There are actual moments where it does cut in the film. But you would go to sleep through Andy Warhol's sleep, and then you would hit Stan Douglas's piece about being between a state of being asleep and awake. You become a voyeur looking at John Giorno sleeping. I don't think it's a coincidence that Warhol chose as the subject for his first long film the subject of sleep. Sure, it had to do with the fact he wanted to shoot his lover John Giorno, but, and it also had to do with the fact of, you know, structuralist filmmaking of the time where you wanted to see the materiality of the film itself. How long would a camera run before the film would run out and he would have to cut? How long could he put the long takes on before they became, you know, something other than cinema? How did it undercut the actual vocabulary of cinema, the way that Hollywood actually cut its movies? This was an anti-Hollywood kind of film. But I think it's more than that. The subject of sleep is about the cinema as well. It's something that you do when you enter the movies. You get into this kind of hypnotic state that is somehow dreamlike, that is trance-like. And so that was one of the reasons. But I'll get back to my quote now. Basically, he says, the spectator is often sent into a fictional space where the exit is hidden or missing altogether. Imagine it simply as the Freudian model of condensation in the dream, one space collapsed into the other. I prefer to call this condensed design a labyrinth effect. And again, that's what we were trying to give in the show itself. Norman Klein also calls these kinds of spaces scripted spaces. That means they're thought out ahead of time. They're scripted, just like a movie. And he talks about, you know, early machines that created extravagant spectacles by Giacomo Torelli in the 17th century, which would also be a precursor to cinema, with complex changes of scenery, jets of water spurting out, and then also, there are these vertiginous sort of illusions of painted domes, such as this one by Fra Andrea Pozzo in San Ignazio in Rome. He talks about Baroque clockwork automatons. He talks about Madame Tussauds wax museums in London, in which we have a work by Hiroshi Sugimoto standing in for that in this lecture. And basically, it seems like it's not inappropriate that it was in a wax museum where, even before the birth of real cinema with the Lumiere brothers, that at the Musée Grévin in Paris, Émile Reynaud presented his praxinoscope, which brought to life animated films. How am I doing on time, Ryan? Okay, great. Well, we just have to cover about another 100 years in 10 minutes. So don't worry, I'll do it. All of this, of course, eventually leads to the ultimate amusement park and the ultimate confusion between cinema and reality, and that is Disneyland, the definitive scripted space of sorts. And it's the amusement park that probably comes the closest to being a three-dimensional version of the movies. Because Disney, when he actually created Disneyland, did not hire architects to design it. He actually hired production people, animators, and set designers to actually get the look of the park right. And they're the ones that actually designed the park. He sought, unlike Luna Park, which had a kind of edginess to it, he sought to give a sense of a kind of Americana and a comfort zone for people within this amusement park. And basically, you know, here's small town America and Tomorrowland being represented here. Small town America probably only existing in Disneyland. Not many places actually had small towns just lie as perfect as this one. But again, to give this sort of sense of it. And the whole park, or most of the park, was actually designed at 5/8 scale, meaning that it was designed almost like a movie set. So you would actually move through the park as if you were a character in one of the films that Disney had made, whether it was in Frontierland or Tomorrowland or Adventureland, you became the actual character. And again, there was this blurring then between what was a film, what was an amusement ride, and yourself as a character acting out these kind of parts as you rode on the rides in Disneyland. Disney wanted a barrier between the real world outside and the world inside, and he called this a berm. That was his term for it, and he was very concerned about the berm being around Disneyland, that so you could not see the parking lots and the housing tracts in Orange County that were just out of sight beyond the berm. Disney was also really interested in the nostalgia for the recent past and for the near future. And so I think that, you know, that brings, again, it, a tighter time frame between what was real and what was not real. You were living in the present, and this was very much about a kind of recent past as opposed to a past in the distance, an Arcadia that might have existed in the 19th century, 18th century gardens in England. This was very much about the recent past, so it could become that much more real. And so what happens here is, you know, what we've got is, you know, reality becoming a kind of fiction. But it wasn't long before other places began to reverse the process and fiction began to move into reality, such as in the Fremont Experience in Las Vegas, which I have a couple images of here. And by the way, one of the artists who designed this was in the exhibition that I worked on called Visual Music, was Jennifer Steinkamp. And what we find is the theme parks now invading actual neighborhoods, neighborhoods created around thematic ideas, or City Walk, a Universal City Walk, which is actually a shopping area that's also part of the actual park itself. These two things becoming blurred, or little communities in Orlando, which tend to take kind of themes from the 19th century and weave them into a way of living, which is almost a fiction rather than reality. The philosopher Jean Baudrillard has actually talked a lot about this, and I want to read a quote from him. He claims that the Magic Kingdom of Disney is presented as imaginary in order to make us believe that the rest is real, when in fact all of Los Angeles and the America surrounding it are no longer real, but of the order of the hyperreal, of simulation. It is no longer a question of false representation of reality, but of concealing the fact that the real is no longer real. Basically, that the real is fiction now. And this is what I think that Godard knew way back in 1965, when he had Paris stand in for the fiction that was supposed to be existing in Alphaville. It was the memory of the 50 years of cinema that had come before at the time that actually populates that cinema, that reality, that Alphaville, that turns it into a kind of experience of cinema and the cinematic itself. Disneyland was another giant step forward in this progressive march toward the blurring of reality and illusion. And at this point with Las Vegas, the berm was no longer necessary. You needed no barrier between reality and illusion. At the same time that Disneyland was being designed, the cinema itself was beginning to question what was real and trying to actually break down the demarcations between the theater space and what you saw on the screen. The old Academy ratio of 1.33 to 1, which was the size of the films from the 30s and 40s, actually began to break down with this idea of technology being able to now create 3D movies and also CinemaScope, which would envelop you in a way that your peripheral vision was also sucked into the image. So you became, in a funny sort of way, like a flaneur walking through a space, because the space now surrounded you. Here's an image of Cinerama from 1952. And one of the advertisements for Cinerama from 1952, which, strangely enough, took as its first movie theme parks. That was the subject matter. You actually went on theme park rides and took tours over America in 1952. So now you are becoming enveloped in the movie, in the space, the distance. The movie existing like a big painting up there was breaking down, and you were becoming part of the actual space of the cinema screen. These are various formats that all came into existence in 1952, 53, thereabouts. There have been a number of filmmakers themselves who have taken up, over the last 20 or so years, this idea of the blurring of illusion and reality and not knowing what is real and what is not. Of course, one of the most famous of these is Ridley Scott's Blade Runner from 1952, in which there's a confusion between humans and replicants, androids, in the film. Or Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days from 1995 with its invention of playback digital recordings of people's lives. Or the Wachowski brothers' The Matrix from 1999 and its questioning of the real and the artificial. And then more recently, films like Michel Gondry's The External Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, in 2004, in which memory can be erased. Through all these films, filmmakers have demonstrated a deep anxiety about what is real and what is not, and how we have arrived at a new era in which our minds have been altered by the moving image. The great year for this, by the way, is 1999, in which a whole slew of films came out exploring this theme, among them The Matrix, but also The Truman Show. So this confused state of mind, this unreal reality, physically manifests itself in these nightmarish scenes that take place in films such as Blade Runner, in which the real world is turned into this sort of gothic nightmare, and in which the real world has become almost cinematic, with buildings actually seeming to be these actual creatures. In a lecture on Georges Méliès, the experimental filmmaker Stan Brakhage referred to something he called an impossible chamber of the imagination. Now, this could refer easily enough to Plato's cave. It could refer to the offspring of Plato's cave, the 17th century magic mirrored compartments of Athanasius Kircher, to the Victorian parlors that were darkened for phantasmagoria magic lantern shows, to the dark recesses of the ornate and exotic movie palaces from cinema's golden era in the 1930s. It might also suggest the darkened living rooms that were dimly lit so you could catch the watery glow of the cathode ray tube of television. And it could also be applied, these impossible chambers of the imagination, to dark chambers in dark rides with their dark labyrinths, or to the cool, shadowy rooms of wax museums. And we could extend it even further to what's sitting right outside of this space here with the black box that we have here at the museum, the artist's need for black box spaces to create moving images in. But I think Brakhage was actually referring to something a lot more than this. He was referring to something that had to do with the changes in our own mentality, with the changes that were happening in our brain, with what he called the gray hills and the valleys of each brain present, holding a thus many-headed host of terrible monsters. So over thousands of years of cinema of all kinds, it's been implanted in our brains, and it's changed the way that we view the world around us. For most of us, reality and fiction are now layered in a continual state of sort of wakeful dreaming. We have turned, as Brakhage suggests, into a monster, a hydra, with a tangle of dangerous angel hair, as he says, that electric thought glass which cuts instinctual nerves to pieces in this most forbidding and utterly foreign landscape of all, which is our minds. And I show you here some images of dream imagery from the cinema. And I want to talk about an interesting paper by someone named Eric Schwitzgebel. In this paper, which was called Why Did We Think We Dreamed in Black and White, he takes on the notion that we dream in black and white, which a lot of us still think. In fact, this was a big notion in the 1940s and the 1950s, that people actually dreamed in black and white. I remember this myself, everyone saying you dreamed in black and white. Well, it's been proven since then that we don't dream in black and white at all, that we actually have colors in our dreams. It's a little more complex than that. But it shows you the power of movies that people who were investigating dreams at the time, all of us, believed we dreamed in black and white because the movies were so much like our dreams. In The Interpretation of Dreams, Freud remarks that the unconscious, insofar as it belongs to the waking thought, needs to be represented in dreams. It is represented in them in underground places. So these underground places, you know, are found in our unconscious, but they're mimicked in the real world through dark chambers. In these unconscious, sunless places we travel through in little cars in dark rides, or slide down projected cones of white light like we do in the Anthony McCall piece Upstairs, until we enter the other side of the screen, until we enter dreamland, or we ride a train there like in Stan Douglas's piece or Bruce Conner's films such as Take the 510 to Dreamland. Since the 1950s, I think, however, the need for dark chambers as passageways into lands of illusion has actually given way to a cinema of the city existing both indoors and outdoors, with Disneyland, Universal City Walk, and the new kind of city in which LED illuminations, high-powered video projections transform buildings into these glowing, pulsating membranes of cinematic motion. With the speed of digital technology that's made the downloading of film possible, with all these things going on, with architecture being illuminated, that it seems that, and it doesn't even have to be at night now, it's powerful enough projection that it can happen in the daytime, it seems that you no longer have to enter even a dark chamber to have the cinematic experience, that it's around you all the time. And a couple pieces in the exhibition might represent the two opposite sides of this. Saskia Olde-Volber's piece called Trailer, in which she films, and by the way, this looks like a digital piece, but in fact, it's not. It's filmed in an aquarium in which she fills it with water and paints models and then puts a little camera down to move through. And she talks in this piece about old-time movies and about old-time theaters, which are sort of disappearing, just like the typewriter is in the Rodney Graham piece, which is standing off against a 35mm projector upstairs. And then the opposite of that, the kind of illuminated city and landscapes that turn up in Michael Bell Smith's piece, Up and Away, which uses from the 1990s various video game footage to create a new kind of cityscape and landscape. And of course, what we all may be nowadays are these kind of somnambulists walking through the cityscape, actually existing in a movie, sleeping all the time. And this is a piece that obviously we couldn't put in the exhibition, but I wanted to draw your attention to because it's by Doug Aitken, who is an artist who did a major piece at MoMA last year, which was projected onto the building. And it actually was called Sleepwalkers, and I think had very much to do with the fact that we're all existing in the movie nowadays. And so I sort of wanted to end with some notions about the idea of sleep. The concept of sleep as a subject matter actually exists throughout history. Here you see a work by Giorgione and finished by Titian called The Sleeping Venus, which maybe is not that much different in a way from Andy Warhol's Sleep or Tony Ousler's pieces, which can look asleep and then suddenly wake up again. But the subject of sleep has become very popular in contemporary artists' work here in Vals Triste, in Bruce Conner's piece, which is actually in the exhibition upstairs, or in a piece by Rodney Graham, not in the exhibition, but called Vexation Island, in which someone keeps waking up and getting hit on the head by a coconut and then falling back to sleep again. Or in a piece we just purchased, actually, for the museum by Hubbard and Birchler, two artists who are represented in the show with a piece called Eight Upstairs, called House with Pool, in which someone sleeps and a kind of dream happens around them. It seems to be something that artists are playing with ever since Warhol actually brought it to the foreground. The shows, as I say, in a way, both the first one, which is about dreams, and the second one, which is about realisms, kind of follow the old dichotomy of the cinema, the dichotomy of Méliès, who introduced, on the right-hand side there, who introduced the idea of the fantastic into the cinema, that it didn't have to be just a recording mechanism, that it could actually tell stories, take you to other places, visit, take you on impossible voyages, which was the name of one of his films. But on the left-hand side, you see the Lumiere brothers, who were more interested in capturing documentary footage and capturing so-called reality. One of the pieces upstairs, which I don't have a slide of, unfortunately, is by an artist based in Berlin named Harun Faraki. And you'll see the workers leaving a factory, which is pictured on the upper left there, at the very beginning of that piece from 1895. And then you're going to see on the 11 monitors which follow that, a work from each one of cinema's decades of workers leaving a factory. country. And some of these would be considered documentaries, and others would be considered fictional films, like The Red Desert, for example, by Antonioni. But in truth, they begin to blur together, and what is actually a document may not be. In fact, it turns out the Lumiere brothers actually staged the workers leaving the factory. This was their own factory in which the workers had been working inside of it, and they wanted to film workers leaving a factory, so they staged it and had them leave in the middle of the day. So what is real, what isn't real, what's illusion, what is reality, turns up all the time, and you'll see it in both, both of these exhibitions. And I want to end with this, two images by Wolfgang Stahle. Wolfgang Stahle has the piece Niagara, which is at the very end of the exhibition. And it's the most, shall we say, realistic piece in the exhibition. We wanted to sort of give you a jolt at the end. Everything had seemed very nightmarish, very dreamy. It was a discussion about the cinematic. And at the very end, we hit you with a piece which is nothing but very realistic, which is just an ongoing, almost streaming image of, no pun intended, the stream of Niagara, or maybe pun is intended, actually, by Wolfgang Stahle. This idea of something that could just be streaming onto your computer in an endless sort of loop of Niagara Falls harks very much back to Frederick Church's paintings of Niagara Falls and to 19th century luminous landscape painting. But is it real? No. It's a video image. It's a DVD. Technology that brings that image inside, and it's no more real than anything else in the show. And I want to end here with talking about this piece on the left. It's not really part of the exhibition, but it's another work by Wolfgang Stahle from 2001, and the piece was actually called 2001. And it was made up actually of a series of projections, one of which was on New York City in 2001. The other was on the Fernsehturm in Berlin, and then there was another one, I've forgotten right now, in a monastery, I believe in Germany somewhere. And these three images were just being streamed constantly into a gallery situation for several months. And as it turned out, one of those months was September, and caught on the screen, just by accident, was 9/11. Was the attacks on the World Trade Center in Wolfgang Stahle's piece. There is a wonderful philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, who has talked a lot about the real and the unreal. And I want to read you just a quick little quote from him about 9/11 and the World Trade Center, which I think is summed up when we think about Stahle's piece. He says, "This is what the captivating image of the collapse of the World Trade Center was. An image, a semblance, an effect. The thing itself, the real itself, in order to be sustained, has to be perceived as a nightmarish, irreal specter." In other words, we couldn't believe this, and the only way we could believe it was to turn it into a movie, to turn it into the cinematic, which is what Karl Stockhausen actually was so criticized for saying at the time, that it was a big spectacle. But it was absolutely true that we kept turning it into a spectacle on television in order to accept it. We had to turn it into the unreal, to the irreal, to a specter in order to even believe that it happened, because we continually live in a world today in which what we believe is actually illusions. So that's what I have today, and that's the end.